Welcome, dear listeners, to Food Conversations Season 6. But of course, first, we acknowledge that we are living and working on the ancestral, unceded, and actually stolen lands of the Shkrepmik people. And I believe that doing what we can to resolve the situation is an important and necessary responsibility for every one of us. This land acknowledgement is particularly relevant now as we near Canada's National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, a day where all of us, Indigenous and non-Indigenous, can come together and work on redressing the colossal imbalance between these two communities and the creation of a better, more equitable society. My guest today has a significant connection to Food Conversations. Claire Askew is a daughter of David Askew, owner of Askew's Foods, a business that has played and continues to play a significant and important role in the commercial and cultural life of Salmon Arm. But apart from bearing the family name, Claire brings a distinctive profile of her own to the worlds of business, volunteerism, and food. And as you'll hear in today's show, an active connection to the world of our Indigenous friends and neighbors. On the volunteer side, she is the president of the Shuswap Food Action Society, to which, in very specific ways, Food Conversations owes its existence. And on the business side, she is the co-owner of AR Broadview Holdings, an enterprise focused on the development of socially and culturally responsible housing with a clear relationship to fostering food sovereignty. Welcome, Claire, to Food Conversations.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're delighted to have you here. And there are so many connections that you and your family and the citizens of Salmon Arm that you are connected with have to this show. It's really a full circle kind of experience for us today. Now, to start off with, a few decades ago, a prominent local business person who was actually the owner of Salmon Arm's earliest commercial radio station took me aside and gave me a bit of a lecture and said, there's an important difference between a business that is directly embedded in the community and a business that is a part of a larger commercial operation whose interests lie well outside the community. Now, you're in a particularly unique position, both from your family's perspective and also your own perspective, to understand this dichotomy. And I wonder if you could just briefly reflect on what you think the differences are between that community-embedded business and one that just is here to further the bottom line for its shareholders.
Thanks for asking. This is, I think this is such an important topic, and I think a lot of people don't totally understand the difference. With local business, we support a lot more local groups. We support local businesses. So a large corporate business often will get all of their printing done even out of country. So from my understanding, Walmart gets their flyers printed in China and then has them shipped into Canada. Local businesses typically will support local accountants, local printers, local office supply businesses. So all of the money that they're spending on these types of services are staying right in your own community. Local businesses are also a lot more able to kind of support at their own will, at their own discretion. They can support local charities. So lots of times the big corporate businesses, they're only going to support the big national charities. And that means that small grassroots organizations that are doing some of the most important work, like Shuswap Food Action, won't get the support because they don't have the big name of the much larger charities.
Yeah. And they can't even understand what's going on in the community all that well, because unless they got their name on it, they're really not, that's all they care about often, just get their name out there somewhere.
Exactly. And I think just local businesses, often the people who own the businesses live in the places where the businesses are operating. So they have this natural interest in seeing the community thrive. And that's something that I learned from my grandfather, from my father, from my aunt, that if you can support the community that you live in, there's a direct connection to your own business thriving.
That's exactly the answer I was hoping you would give. And I'm delighted, because you can speak it with a certain sense of authority and authenticity, because you're right in the middle of that process. Now, although you're a member of the Salmon Arms Askew family, you were born in Toronto, then you moved to Nelson when you were six, and then to Vancouver when you were eight, and then back to Toronto, and then back to Vancouver, and now have been 6 years in Salmon Arm. But with all that traveling and moving from one place to another, somewhat like your peripatetic father, you've always had a connection to this town. Why don't you talk about that a little bit? Talk about summer holidays, but also in your own mind, how you viewed yourself and the connection to this community.
Growing up, we would come to the shoe shop. My grandparents bought a cabin out past Sunnybrae, actually the year I was born.
The year you were born, which we will not reveal to the waiting public.
And so I was fortunate enough to get to spend my summers there. When we were living in Toronto, my grandparents would pay to fly our whole family, and we'd come for a month. So I really got to just kind of sink into the summer and enjoy time with family on the lake. I think that started my love of being here. While I was spending all this time with family, I would hear a lot about the town, about what was happening with the business. I think that's something about family businesses is there's not a lot of separation between family life and the business. It's all totally intertwined. I remember hearing so much about the fall fair and the float that Askew's would be busily working on through the summer.
Well, you also spent time in all these other places. And I wonder if you have any sort of standout memories, just some signature memories for you. For example, in Toronto, now you were, you were only six when you left Toronto the first time. What do you remember about that time? It's a big urban center, you know, the biggest urban center in the country. Do you have any memories from there?
Some of my fondest memories are going to the business district near our house. We lived in an Italian neighborhood, and the neighbor and the business street was filled with little delis, gelato shops. I have a lot of memories of going for ice cream in the summer. It was a very vibrant urban living.
Do you remember the smells?
Yes, the sounds.
That's where the emotions come from, is the smells, yeah. As a kid, you would.
Yes, and my mother loved it there. So when your parents love a place, I think it kind of...
It's a bit contagious. And then Nelson. Now, Nelson was your first experience in a small town yourself. What was Nelson like? It was only a couple of years, but what was it like for you?
Those were the two most magical years of my childhood. I loved the freedom child gets in a small town like that. I went to the Waldorf school, which was up on the mountain. The Waldorf philosophy is about giving kids a lot of freedom. It's really about nurturing children's imagination. There is a little bit of element of allowing children to take risks. I think at that school at that time, that was particularly encouraged.
Yes, the helicopter parents are parked at the door.
Exactly. So we'd spend our lunch hours tromping around in the forest. We actually found a little brook that we would go swimming in unbeknownst to our teachers. There were streams everywhere. It was, looking back on it, it's not surprising that it was such a magical time for me.
Well, I think you've described what a lot of children would really like to have had, the opportunity, as you say, to take a few risks, maybe to have a sharp implement in their hand, knowing that if they used it properly, it would be very nice to use, but if they didn't, it would be very unpleasant. So the next time, that was, and it's interesting how magical that was, because it certainly is something that I can see as a theme when, and our listeners will hear this, about going where your imagination took you, not being, within the straitjacket, the coloring within the lines kind of approach. Now, one thing you'd said to me before the show was that both your grandfather and your father, and I would say to some extent your great-grandfather, were community-oriented in a very real sense. What does that phrase mean to you, community-oriented?
I think in part it goes back to what I was saying. So for them, making sure that we have a strong community is completely tied up with the strength of the business. A lot of the work that they did was around supporting local food systems, making sure that we're supporting small suppliers, supporting the fall fair. My grandfather ran the abattoir in town. I have memories of going with him to the Armstrong Fall Fair and watching him bid on the prize-winning steer from the 4-H Club.
Soon to be steak.
Yes.
So you were, it's the sense I think listeners are getting, that you were kind of surrounded by this family atmosphere that had certain prominent elements in it, and one was being involved with community in multiple different ways. Well, your growing up years were geographically diverse, but also as time went by, your studies and pursuit of learning was also intellectually diverse. So after high school, your first foray into higher education was at the University of Saskatchewan. Now, why did you pick the University of Saskatchewan? I know I've been to, you know, the University of Saskatchewan, not to study, but the campus, but it's not on your travel list up to that point. What was it about there that drew you?
I had a good childhood friend who had grown up going to Saskatchewan in the summers. Her family was all from there, and she was planning to go to the University of Saskatchewan, so that was part of the reason. And another main reason was I had become obsessed with basketball by that point. And Saskatchewan had a good team at that time in the Women's League for Canadian basketball. The Western Conference was considered the strongest. And so I was determined to try and make a team in the Western Conference. And the coach at University of Saskatchewan said she was interested.
There you are. You were looking as a, you were a prospect for the Canadian team, which, of course, Salmon Arm has a fairly noble history in that regard as well, with Bev Smith and others. But you didn't stay in Saskatchewan. You moved on to McMaster to complete what became a BA, a bachelor's degree in history, specifically focusing in the area of Indigenous studies and health and healing. What diverted you into that?
I started in general history, and McMaster has they cross-list a lot of their courses with Indigenous studies and other courses. It's a really nice interdisciplinary way of doing things. So I kind of stumbled into Indigenous studies that way, and I took some classes and just became really interested.
And on it went, and as listeners will hear, it went further. I think it's important to point out that your veering towards studying Indigenous ways was actually a number of years before all of Canada became alive to the reality of Indigenous experience through the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was a few years later, from 2008 to 2015. What was it about what you learned about Indigenous ways that just piqued your interest? It made you think there was something there?
My family has been quite involved in different equity and social justice campaigns. My father had done quite a bit of work on peace, and my sister's always been a passionate activist. So I grew up in that kind of a household, and taking these Indigenous studies classes, at the time that I went to high school, it really wasn't part of the curriculum to learn about colonization. I hadn't even learned about the residential school system. So an undergraduate taking these courses, learning about all of what had happened was really shocking. And I think it just went from there for me.
I just remind listeners that I have as a guest today Claire Askew, who is the president of the Shuswap Food Action Society, as well as A&R business, and that we're talking about her long engagement with the community here and many of the processes of, you mentioned with your father and your family about social activism. You continued that when you were at McMaster and I'm sure and in Saskatchewan, involved with Oxfam Fair Trade Coffee, which is, there's the food again, and has now become a fairly major thing. After that, you went back to Vancouver, and there you started and completed a master's degree in gender and women's studies at Simon Fraser. What triggered that transition, or was it just an extension of what you've been doing before?
I had a bunch of different topics that I was really interested in delving into further. One of the topics that I studied when I was doing my Women's Studies and Gender master's was looking at the food meat industry. And I had a professor who specialized in ecofeminism. So she was interested in helping me look at this topic through an ecofeminist lens. I delved into the impact of women whose partners work in factory farm style abattoirs and topics like the high rates of domestic abuse for women whose partners are working in these facilities. I looked at meat consumption. I'd always been a vegetarian, which was a little bit ironic because I come from a long line of butchers. My great-grandfather, grandfather, and even my father was trained as a butcher when he was young. Hmm.
And it's interesting, too, because I think your grandfather and your great-grandfather in particular were kind of paterfamilias. They fitted into the kind of male-dominated patriarchy, not in a pretty benign way. It was part of many other considerations. Was that way down there in the back of your mind when you were studying, doing women's studies and gender relations? Did it ever cross your mind that you were branching away from a bit of a tradition in the older part of the family?
I don't think I thought about it too much, but I see what you're saying, and I think I was lucky because I was raised being told that I could pursue anything that I wanted to pursue, and I know that's such a privilege.
Yeah, and I think your father really made that a point to make sure that that happened, and we're all the beneficiaries of his intent. So you're at the university studying a broader, moving on to a broader approach, but also next you go back to a university now called Toronto Metropolitan University. And I'm just going to lay out a little bit of background there because it's of some relevance to the National Reconciliation Day that is approaching. It used to be called Ryerson University, and it was named after Egerton Ryerson, who was a Methodist minister and educator, but the name was changed because Ryerson was also a staunch supporter of the residential school system that ended up traumatizing Indigenous communities and families and individuals for decade after decade. One writer described him thus. He said, "Ryerson ignored alternative visions and promises that saw Indigenous education as a pathway to equality and self-governance, instead recommending an educational system intended to turn Indigenous students into a racialized, subservient class." That's pretty clearly against the tone of what's happening today. And in fact, on June the 7th, 2021, Ryerson's statue was toppled and beheaded, and the head of the statue placed on a spike at the Six Nations of the Grand River Reserve near Caledonia, Ontario. And to complete the circle, on April the 6th, 2022, the name change to Toronto Metropolitan University was formally announced. Now, you pursued your studies while it was still called by its old and now discredited name, but you'd already studied Indigenous food policy years earlier, and we will talk about your parallel involvement with the Native Education College in Vancouver in a moment. But what are your thoughts and reflections about this tumultuous aspects of years past? You were there. There must have been some seeds being sown around you, whether you were directly involved or not. Do you recall what the flavor of that time was?
I wasn't involved in any conversations about that exactly, but you're right. The university, it's a very progressive university, so the name really didn't fit. My supervisor, Mustafa Koch, he was the founder of Food Secure Canada, which is a very progressive food organization in Canada. And that university did draw a lot of these progressive, very left-wing type thinkers. So in hindsight, I'm not surprised that it went down this way.
Yes, it was obviously a process that it was a process. It wasn't an event. It was a process leading toward the final outcome that took place. So you were working on a PhD in policy studies, studying how policies happen, what they do, but specifically focusing on food policies, and even more narrowly or precisely on school food policies. Why don't you talk about how that set of foci kind of caught your attention and led you on? What was it about that?
One of the things I was looking at in my master's in women and gender studies was the way that traditional food skills have been devalued, in part because they've been associated with women's work. So cooking, canning food, preserving food, gardening. Within Western society, we've often associated this with women's work, and prominent feminists like Betty Friedan of the Second Wave advocated for women to get out of the kitchen, that we needed to release women from the kitchen to free them from this kind of work. And it is understandable because so many women did it completely on their own in these, you know, totally isolated positions in the house, and often their husbands weren't helping at all with this work. So you could see why it could have been viewed as real drudgery.
Some of the advertisements from the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and 70s are astonishingly misogynistic. Without anybody seemed to, I remember one ad where a husband had his wife over his lap and she was spanking her because she hadn't done the laundry right or something. It's astonishing that we had that only a few decades ago.
Yes.
So you saw the other side of the story.
Right. Well, I studied third wave feminism in my master's, and part of third wave feminism is looking at, no, this type of work is not women's work. It's important, it's essential work, but it's work for everyone to be doing, and it doesn't have to be work. If we all share in this, it can be really rewarding, it's so nourishing, it's really important environmentally that we do this work. So that was a part of the third wave feminist movement that I was interested in. And then in my PhD, I progressed from that to looking at, okay, well, we see that this work, that children aren't learning to cook, they're not learning to garden, they're not learning any of these really important skills at home anymore, partly because a lot of this knowledge has been lost. So it's now maybe more important than ever that this type of learning happens in the school system. And that's when I became really interested in looking at food education in schools.
It's interesting how these successive waves of feminist thinking actually lead to new information coming forward. For example, there's a Viking grave in Sweden, which for years was always assumed to be the grave of a male because it was full of weapons and implements of war, until somebody got the DNA from the bones of the person who was in his grave, fated and honored to an enormous extent in her society because she was a woman. And there's also a recent book that came out called Everyday Life in the Ice Age. And it documents the fact that the work was inevitably done by both men and women. If there was a physically demanding job, maybe a male might do it, you know, small brain, strong back. But when it came to remarkably skilled and important jobs, they were as much done by women as by men. And it's simply because we opened our eyes to the fact that this could be a possibility collectively. The human race is learning. And Claire, I think you're at the forefront of this learning process. So at the same time that you were studying, you were also becoming involved with the what is known as the Native Education Center. Now, the name is a little old-fashioned. I think most Indigenous people would use other terms to describe themselves, but it was still an important center of learning and cultural development for Indigenous people and for you as a non-Indigenous person. So tell listeners a little about the NEC, the Native Education College. What was it like?
I loved working there. I was there for 5 years. It's a small college in Vancouver. There's only a few Indigenous colleges in BC. There's another one in Merritt called NVIT. The college offers programs for students completing their high school, and then also offers programs that are transferable to universities. The programs that I taught in were the Family Community Counseling Program. I also taught in the Aboriginal Justice Studies Program. I mainly taught English and writing courses in those programs. Students from those programs go on to become counselors, they'll become youth justice workers, parole officers, lawyers. It's a wonderful jumping off place. There's tons of cultural components at the college. They do a welcome ceremony. The students all say what nation they're from. They do blanket making courses. They have a resident elder who's there to speak with students. The college itself is in this really beautiful cedar longhouse.
Mm. Sounds like you were immersed. How many other non-Indigenous people would there have been besides yourself in the family of the NEC?
All of the students are Indigenous, and I'd say about half the staff would have been Indigenous and at the time that I was there, which was 6 years ago.
Yeah, I would guess that over time there would be more as time went by. Some of the things, in fact, that you were involved in at the college were the names and the focus of the work you were doing. Wellness warriors, for example. Wellness warriors, the literacy coordinators, so many things open up for you when you are literate. And that has been an obstacle for a number of people. Of Indigenous background. But one important addition was that your sister worked there too. What was that like, having Hannah as one of your co-workers in your workplace?
Actually, she didn't work there at the same time as me. She was just leaving as I was starting. And the literacy coordinator position that I took on was a position that she advocated for many years, as she saw that this was a gap in the programming. She created the position. She designed, that's one of her special skills, is curriculum design. She designs the most amazing curriculum. So she had already put that all together. The position was posted, and then I applied for it. So I did have a bit of an advantage.
I would say, yes. But what did you add to it? I mean, there were other things you were involved in that she wasn't. For example, a sports program related to health. I think you had a bit of a hand in developing that. So it wasn't just that you came after her, you also did some things that were an extension of what she'd done as well. Talk about that health through sports kind of approach. What was that about?
That's a passion of mine. While I was working as the literacy coordinator, I noticed that there wasn't any athletic offerings in the student services at the college. And being a student athlete in my university days, it was something that I loved and was really passionate about. And so off the side of my desk, I started with starting a co-ed basketball program. And the first practice, we put some posters up around the college. The first practice, we had about 40 people show up. So I thought, oh my goodness, there is a serious interest in sports at this college. And it went from there. I started applying for grants. There's quite a few little grants that you can apply for if you're interested in starting an Indigenous sport program.
Sure.
So it just really ballooned from there. We ended up adding a soccer team, a dragon boating team. We started a mentorship program that was incorporated. We put on these large-scale basketball. We had one at SFU that we called the Indigenous Basketball Festival, and this was a large basketball tournament. We had Indigenous teams coming from as far as Saskatchewan, and then we incorporated a lot of cultural elements. We had Indigenous performers. We had bannock. We had an Indigenous caterer that provided some really yummy food.
It's interesting how there are common interests that all people have, one of which is to be physically active and involved with either a sport or just physical activity in general. But there are different cultural ways of doing it. I'm struck by the notion of Indigenous paddlers in a dragon boat, which is essentially from the Far East, and in a program inspired by a non-Indigenous person who is respectful of and sensitive to what they're trying to accomplish in this activity. It's the way the world, I think, needs to go, and it's wonderful that you were a part of it. You didn't get to the very end of your PhD, and it was partly to do with involvement with the NEC, but also just changes that were taking place around that time for you. A lot of people, when they embark on a program, they have this feeling they have to get to the end and dot the I's and cross the T's. You had the independent confidence to say, I don't need to do that. What was it that led you, as some people would consider it, astray, but it was clearly in the right direction for you?
I began to realize that getting my PhD was going to be no easy feat, especially for me when research and writing wasn't my biggest strength. It was becoming harder and harder. I did get through my comprehensive exams, which I was really happy about, and I was becoming more and more passionate and interested in this Wellness Warriors program that I was running at the Native Education College. And I began to realize that this was more my strength: program development, building new programs, collaboration, that these were more my strengths than the academic route.
Did Hannah take it well?
So I had mentioned before the show that my sister Hannah, she is an academic superstar. She had been approached by a number of professors wanting to collaborate, and she really influenced me on my path through my PhD and helped me a lot. And we did have the younger sister, older sister dynamic. She took it fine, though.
I could imagine that the Askew family has dealt with far greater issues than that. And I think it is important for all of us, and it's probably a lesson everyone has to learn, is to follow the path that works for you the best. Remind listeners again that I'm speaking with Claire Askew, who is the president of the Shuswap Food Action Society, and as well the co-owner of AR Broadview Holdings, which is an enterprise working on socially and culturally responsible housing. So you moved away from the PhD program, and in 2017, or at that time, you came back to, or, as it turns out, the first time to come and live in Samarang. What was that like? You'd had all sorts of transitory connections. You'd had thoughts and feelings and family connections, etc. What was it like to actually come and live here?
I remember driving along the highway past the water slides and feeling really nervous. I didn't think I'd ever actually move here. I'd always wanted to. I'd always dreamed of joining the family business, but there's a lot of different moving parts in that business and a lot of different family members involved, and I'd pretty well given up hope. And then the situation changed and I was able to join the business. It was a big deal. My husband Cole is born and raised in Vancouver, and when I first met him, he had said, I had told him that I would love to move to Salmon Arm, and he had said there's no way he would move to a small town like Salmon Arm.
Well, it's a testament to your persuasive nature that he actually did come and is flourishing. So you felt nervous. How long did you stay feeling nervous?
Didn't take too long.
What was it that made it work for you, being back in this sort of family home?
Partly is I didn't realize that I would meet this amazing group of friends who are really like-minded. I didn't realize there would be such community and people like you too here that I would really connect with, that I would have similar ideas. Connecting with the Shoeshop Food Action Society was something that I wasn't expecting.
Why don't we talk about that? Because that was sort of a person-to-person, and as you've been talking, you've been making reference to relationships, individual relationships with individual people. And that's sort of what happened with the Food Action Society. You met Serena Kaner. What was that like?
I met her at the pool. We're both in master swimming. I had heard little things about her, that she was doing this interesting work. She has so many creative, inspiring ideas. And when she got involved at that point, I just felt I was too overwhelmed with. I had two really little kids and I was starting this new job. But over the years, I heard more and more about it from her and eventually joined the board.
And you joined the board because what was it you thought could bring to the board? Because clearly you have a practical streak that says we're going to accomplish something here. What did you think you could bring to the board?
One of the things that I love doing is building programs, building organizations. I thought that as a new as a grassroots organization with Serena seeming to want to build the organization, I felt that that was one of the things that I could bring. Another part of my background is fundraising. When I was at NEC, as I mentioned, with the Wellness Warriors program, that program was started completely from scratch. So I hit the ground running, learning how to fundraise. And that journey inspired me to take the fundraising program at BCIT and sign up for the Association of Professional Fundraisers mentorship program. I had a wonderful mentor who taught me tons about fundraising. And I know that every nonprofit needs fundraisers.
Yeah. Yes, as a nonprofit radio station, we know that only too well. Yeah, so did that get, how did you kick that off as a fundraising branch of what the Shoeshop Food Action Society does?
I've helped Melanie with the Coldest Night of the Year event.
Melanie Bennett, who is the project coordinator for the Shoeshop Food Action Society, who's also fairly dynamic.
Yes, she is an amazing fundraiser. If she wasn't doing this, I'm sure she would be a highly sought after fundraiser. She's so tenacious and also creative in coming up with ways to help sponsors. She really sees it as a two-way street and goes way above and beyond. And that's something that I learned in fundraising. Number one rule, under promise, over deliver. And Melanie is an expert at that when it comes to donor relations.
I always like to remind listeners that Melanie's previous life was as a wedding coordinator. I think that's a real challenge, and learning to handle that kind of situation probably prepared her very well for what you're describing now. So fundraising and activities within the Shoeshop Food Action Society has been a part. You're now the president of the society. But there's another whole pattern to your life, and I think this is where your work with Cole, your husband, has started to play a major role. Cole has a family and an educational background in business, with specific training in project management at the BCIT, BC Institute for Technology. And in addition, of course, there's Askew's is a business. Askew's Foods is a business and has been involved in land management and land acquisition in order to have stores built on property that belongs to the company, so that there's a kind of integrated process in developing a business. In addition, your father talked, and you've mentioned this already now, but maybe you could elaborate on this a little bit, about how a community develops, about things like mixed-use neighborhoods, about things like walkability. Maybe you can talk a little bit about how that led into what you're doing now with the business, the AR Broadview Holdings.
My father is really interested in those principles that you just mentioned. Walkability, the downtown Askew's is a real passion of his, and it's partly because of its location supporting other local downtown businesses. He sees a future where having grocery stores in the core is only going to become more important as we deal with the climate crisis and needing to do more infill development, needing people to live closer to their everyday essential spots that they're going to. The uptown development, he brought in a lot of interesting pieces, things like parking lot design. How can we design a parking lot that's more aesthetically pleasing than just a huge concrete pad? He brought in different green building components that the building has won awards for.
What was it like watching that process unfold? You were actually, it was happening, as they say, on your watch. What did you feel about that?
It was interesting. I could see that he was losing a lot of sleep, which now I'm learning is part of a developer's life. You put your personal assets on the line, so it's understandable that you can lose some sleep.
So in the conversations that you had with your dad, a term emerged which caused great perplexity for my spell check on my computer. The term is agrihood. Now, that could, if you didn't know what that meant, you could think, well, that might be good. But then again, maybe it isn't. Maybe it's where criminals hang out in the fields or something like that. Why didn't you give us all and the least listeners a definition of an agrihood?
An agrihood is a community that's built around a community farm or even a larger farm. It's sometimes called food-supported real estate. The idea is that you're using fees, often strata fees, to help support the production of local food. A lot of agrihoods will hire a farm manager. They're often designed for busy professionals, people who are interested in gardening, interested in supporting local food, eating local food, but don't actually have the time or the skills to do their own local food production. So these agrihoods will have often a full-time farm manager who will manage the farm. Sometimes, depending on the type of development, sometimes they'll be multifamily. Sometimes they'll just have single-family homes, and those people may have their own small garden. And then the big farm, usually there's so much produce there that some of it will go to the market, or sometimes you'll have a farm stand so the public can also access this food that's being produced. And having the strata fees helps to support, as we know, farming can be not a very lucrative undertaking.
Yeah, in some parts of the world, and this is one of them. The concept seems like everybody's dream who lives, say, in a big city. Wouldn't it be nice to live right next to a farm or to countryside? And that's incorporated in a very practical way from what you're describing. It's not just there's countryside, there's natural landscapes and that kind of thing, but a lot of them are also being used to produce the means of existence, food, which is central to that. Your concept, if I understand correctly, involves not so much individual homes, but shared housing. So rentals or some other form of shared housing where people are living in a communal building, and communal relations within the agrihood are also an important part of what you're trying to talk about that for a little bit.
Well, there's a whole spectrum of what they call food-focused development, and the agrihood is often a much larger development. The project we're working on right now is a multifamily rental building, so we've designed 2 7-plexes that will be purpose-built rentals. That means that they won't ever be anything but rentals. So people moving into those will know that they won't have to move, which can be a big problem for renters.
It's interesting that you brought that up, because there is a lot of discussion about what's better, owning your own home or renting renting allows flexibility, owning your own home allows a different kind of flexibility. But ultimately, the notion that everybody should have their own home, which is a relatively new idea. Historically, we have tended to live in communal homes for most of our existence on the planet as a separate species. So the idea that everybody has a separate home physically apart from all the others is something that people sometimes considered as a cherished dream, but it does mean that you're on your own and you don't have that benefit of connecting to other people as much. So you're building in this communal flavor, if you like, this communal pattern into the way you're working on the project you're on now. And the gardens are in that space. The space has a little agricultural component built right in. Parking is a big issue that people address when they're building structures in our culture. And you're thinking of doing it differently with respect to parking. Why don't you talk about that?
For this development, we will be doing pretty standard parking, but I'm really interested in how we can move towards developments that do parking differently. There's a lot of new information coming out that's linked with housing affordability that's looking at how not just large cities, but even smaller cities like Salmon Arm are beginning to change their policies around parking. Currently, we require, Salmon Arm requires parking for all multifamily buildings. It varies depending on the location, how much parking is required. More and more municipalities are actually eliminating parking requirements. So it's left totally up to the developer. This doesn't mean that you end up with way less parking, because it depends on the location. It depends on what the developer thinks, if there will be a demand for housing without parking. But there's other things that municipalities can do that I'm really interested in. There's a movement towards putting in pay parking in business districts. And the reason for this is because when you don't have pay parking, you have staff parking on the street and not using the off-street parking. And this leads to a sense that there's a parking shortage in your town. But what the research shows is that when you put paid parking in your entire business district, you end up having way less staff parking on the street. And contrary to popular thought, you don't actually see less people coming to your business district to shop. And that's something that I find so interesting, because I've been on the Downtown Improvement Association for the last 5 years, and it comes up several times a year, the idea of putting in paid parking. And the thought has always been, if we put in paid parking, everyone's just going to shop at the mall because the parking's free at the mall. But the research actually shows that when you put metered parking on your streets in your downtown business district, there's no drop in the number of people coming to your downtown. And in fact, you'll often see an uptick, because there are people who aren't coming to the business district because they find the parking too chaotic. They're not sure if they're going to be able to find a spot on the street. But once you meter the parking, you get staff not parking on the street anymore, which then means that there's more parking available for shoppers.
So I think you're also connected to the Parking Commission.
Yes, so this has become a new passion of mine. I've just joined the Parking Commission. And the way it ties in with development is that developers looking to do more walkable infill-style developments, when they come to a business district and they see that there's no parking, then they feel, okay, well, there's not enough on-street parking, so clearly there's a parking shortage, so we're going to need to build a lot of parking. But actually, if you can get your parking management right, then there may be a sense on the part of the developers that maybe not quite so much parking is required, and then they may take the plunge and develop downtown. Because I know some of our city planners, they would love to see more infill development in our downtown, but it's just not really happening.
The other thing that's an issue with respect to parking is that parking is for vehicles. And a number of large urban centers, Vancouver is quite well known for this, have raised the rates for parking, as well as having very competent and accessible public transportation. And what happens, of course, is that people use fewer individual vehicles and use public transport, and then inevitably start walking a bit more. And all of that brings about health. And of course, it also mitigates our pressure on the climate crisis. We do less to make that worse because we're not generating as much greenhouse gases. The amount of greenhouse gas produced by a bus versus all those people in the bus riding in individual cars, it's quite astonishingly different. And that affects food. So that there's a kind of interconnectedness among these issues. And I think I get the sense that your way of looking at things involves allowing that interconnectedness to come to the forefront rather than dealing with issues separate from one another.
Yes, exactly.
Could you elaborate a little bit how important that is?
I think there's so many pieces to it. With this infill development discussion, I can only imagine if we had a 100-unit apartment building in the courtyard behind Shoe Shop Pie Co., how good would that be for our Saturday farmers market?
Very good indeed. They would have a ready customer base. It's interesting when Walmart and Smart Centers wanted to build on the Delta here, they planned to have a high-rise apartment building at the mouth of the Salmon River for a captive audience of buyers who would, needless to say, walk over to Walmart or associated stores in order to buy. So the principle is well understood within the retail industry. If you have a geographical closeness between residents and markets, then they tend to fit together very, very well, and also in this case reduce fossil fuel use, which I think is an important principle that we've mentioned many times here. Your husband is Cole is the technical guy behind this. He's the one who has to go and talk to permitting agencies and stuff like that. That sounds like he's come to accept that life in a small town can be fulfilling. How's that process for him been in terms of adapting to what he's obviously doing that's very useful now?
Yes, I think he's settled right in, and he is doing the more stressful part of this work. He also deals with all the budgeting and the finances. He has a finance background. He did his business degree at Bishop's University, so he's really strong in that area.
And so he's actually discovering that the skills he had acquired, which he thought were related to larger urban centers, can be manifested and utilized in a small place like this.
Yeah, and he's actually finding there's more opportunity for development in a place like Salmon Arm, even though land prices in Salmon Arm are high. When you compare to Vancouver, he was looking at doing some small development projects, and the numbers are just almost impossible.
There they are. Now, it's interesting there's a full circle here for you as well, because there's one of the things you would like to have here is a Waldorf school. To as well as a garden and as well as rental housing where people have communal patterns. Communal patterns are also important for you. Just briefly, we're nearing the end of the show, but that notion of relationships at all levels, both between neighbors and within people who are shaping the community and people who are bringing products into the community, that seems to be a central theme for much of what you're doing.
Yes, there are a number of people in Salmon Arm who are interested in working on these types of projects together. And I think going back to what you were saying at the beginning of the show about small business, it's the same applies with small developers and small-scale building. When you get small-scale developers coming together, they're really interested in the community, building for what's good for the community. I think the Waldorf School it'll be too late for my kids, but I loved it so much and I can see what a good thing it is for the world. So if we can incorporate a Waldorf School into one of our plans in the future, could be neat.
The kids would be out in the garden every day because it would be right next door. Claire, I want to thank you for being on the show, for bringing both a broad and a local perspective. You know, you have multiple interactions and connections to the community. It's, I think, been very enlightening for listeners to hear about the work that's involved with both Askew's Food, but also your own ambitions for developing an integrated kind of community where where you don't have one place where you do one thing and another place where you do another, but you have opportunities to do all of the fulfill all of your ambitions in your life in one place. I want to thank you again. I want to let listeners remember about the work that you're doing with AR Broadview Holdings, that it's a business, but like Askew's Foods, it's a business that's thinking about the community at its core and not simply profit-taking. And I think that's an important principle you laid out for us in great detail, and thank you very much for that.
Thank you for having me. It's a real honor to be on the show.